The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the White Collar Crime edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. And oh my God, do we have a cracker of a show for you this week. I'm Felix Salmon of Fusion. I'm joined, as ever, by Anna Szymanski.
Hello.
And not one, but two incredibly special guests. We have a guy who's been on this show once or twice before, Jesse Eisinger.
Thank you for having me back.
Welcome. You have a day job at ProPublica.
As much as anyone can have a day job
and
at ProPublica.
Yet somehow you have also managed to produce a weighty tome. You have a book out.
It is an enjoyable, brisk read. I completely object to that characterization.
Plug your book, Jesse.
The Chicken Shit Club, coming out from Simon & Schuster on Tuesday. It is a book about how the federal government lost the will and ability to prosecute top corporate officers.
We are going to be talking about Jesse's book, which is a thrilling read, an enjoyable tome. You can take it to the beach. Buy it on Tuesday so it hits the top of the Amazon list on the week it comes out.
You'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll want to join the revolution.
And yeah, you'll read lots of nice things about Jim Comey, which you wrote before he became, you know, topic number.
The Jim Comey, yeah.
We also have, because Jesse is not enough for this amazingly packed show, we are going to talk about Jesse's book, of course. We are going to talk about the culture of impunity in Silicon Valley and all of the sort of fallout from the endemic sexual harassment that has been going on there. And we are also, because we have to, we are going to talk about this completely bonkers Hobby Lobby antiquities smuggling
the best
case.
Story ever.
It's such a great story. And to help us talk about that, we have Larry Coben.
Hi, Felix.
Larry, you have so many, you are many, many things. How can we introduce you?
I'm a former businessman turned archaeologist turned preservationist.
There you go. So, Larry, and you're also a lawyer.
I have a law degree.
And you're also a banker.
I guess once a lawyer, always a lawyer. No, I've actually never been a banker.
You've never been a banker.
It's the one profession, in fact, of all the 100 professions available in New York that I have never been.
So Larry is going to be helping to guide us with the aid of his archaeology doctorate through some of the complexities of the Hobby Lobby case. We will get to that. But first, let's talk about the Chicken Shit Club. This is actually a Jim Comey phrase, is it not, Jesse?
Yes. In 2002, before you may know him from such roles as the former FBI director fired by President Trump, but before this, long before this, in 2002, Comey became the most powerful federal prosecutor after the attorney general, arguably the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. And
this is the role that Preet Bharara was fired from.
Yes, exactly. Preet just and Robert Morgenthau before him. It's an incredibly important office, the most important office for prosecuting corporate crime in America, I would say. And Comey gathered all the young prosecutors in the office, the criminal prosecutors together. And these guys really, you have to understand, are the best of the best of the best. They went to the best schools, the best law schools, best clerkships. They're the hottest shots. And if you have any doubt, you can just ask any one of them. They will assure you.
They'll be happy
you.
To tell you.
Yes. Comey gives a speech. He loves speeches, as you know. He loves the limelight, as President Trump pointed out. And so he says, I want to give you guys a talk. And he said, how many of you guys have never lost a case? And a bunch of hands shoot up because these guys are the best lawyers in the country. And he says, me and my friends have a name for you guys, the Chicken Shit Club. And a bunch of hands go back down. And they get a little sheepish. And so what did he mean by that? And why did I title the book this? Well, what he meant was, if you are Your job is not about winning. Your job is to do justice, to bring righteous cases. And if you're not taking on the most powerful wrongdoers in the country, then you are not doing your jobs.
And we know that in this kind of capitalist society, the most powerful people are the corporate bigwigs, the CEOs, and it's hard to bring cases against those people.
It is hard. But what I argue is that from that time, which was the last high point of prosecuting top corporate executives, you know, when we prosecuted Enron and WorldCom and Tyco and Adelphia and Global Crossing, et cetera, we prosecuted the top executives from many of those companies. From that time, in the last decade and a half, the Department of Justice has lost the will and skill set to be able to do this. And I argue that's why they don't prosecute them now. And this is why top corporate executives in this country have impunity to commit crime.
And I know you also point out in the book that with the Enron case, especially in terms of what happened with Arthur Andersen, that that was a big deal in terms of creating this idea that if you prosecuted individuals as well as the companies they worked with, you could put them out of business. And then that became kind of the symbol of prosecutorial overreach. And then that was used as an excuse, essentially, to then not move forward with larger cases with the idea of like, what could be the systemic impact?
Yeah, exactly. So Enron is the last high point, but also the turning point, because there's a backlash against the Enron prosecutions, mainly against Arthur Andersen, because they put the company out of business. And what I seek to do in the book is to rehabilitate that decision and explain why I think it was justified, what Andersen was as an entity, because I think it was a corrupted entity that was the handmaiden to not just Enron's accounting fraud, but WorldCom, Waste Management, Sunbeam, the list goes on and on. And but instead, what happens is they prosecute that company successfully. It does go out of business, and that is unfortunate for the workers. Most of the employees got found jobs. But what happens is there's an enormous corporate lobbying and defense bar backlash against that, and many other things over the course of the next decade. And they win the argument. The companies win the argument. And what they end up doing is convincing the Department of Justice that they were overly aggressive about prosecuting corporate crime. They decide that they can't indict companies that are too big to fail or too sensitive or will have these collateral consequences. And they turn to settling with corporations for money. And in doing that, they lose sight of this vital thing for ensuring justice in America, which is that they forget and they don't emphasize prosecuting individual actors, which in fact is the solution to worries about systemic risk.
So there seem to be three levels of prosecution here, that you can either just settle a case for money, or if you want to go harder, you can try and indict the company. And then if you want to go harder still, you can try and prosecute the individuals, criminally prosecute the individuals who run that company. Arthur Andersen, the individuals were largely unscathed, no?
Well, there was – the reason why they were able to prosecute it successfully is that one top individual pleaded guilty to obstruction of justice for – Arthur Andersen was Enron's auditor and destroyed
– lots of documents.
Literally tons and tons of documents. Right before it was subpoenaed, but Enron had been subpoenaed. There was obviously a criminal and civil investigation into it. Your order is exactly what the Department of Justice sort of has defaulted to, which is settlement first, possibly some kind of indictment, although that's essentially off the table. And wouldn't it be nice to prosecute individuals? And my argument would be you need to reverse that and emphasize bringing individuals to justice. This is extremely difficult. I don't think this is an easy job. But then again, Preet Bharara didn't sign up for an easy job. If he wants an easy job, he can plant daylilies in his backyard. Then you can try to settle with a corporation or indict the corporation if appropriate. You shouldn't take that off the table. And then finally, if you haven't indicted them, you do reach a settlement. I don't think that these things are should be banned, but I think that they should be de-emphasized.
So let me bring Larry in here. As someone who's been in the corporate world long enough to predate Enron, Is there any reason to believe that the behavior of corporate executives over the past decade is in any way more law-abiding than it was back when we had all of these prosecutions?
I think we certainly went through a stretch post-Enron when it was more law-abiding. And I should say that post-bankruptcy, and I'll make it clear, post-bankruptcy, I was on one of the two Enron boards, so I was fairly close to what happened, at least with respect to the international assets. And I'm a board chairman today of a public company. But yes, a lot of processes were put in place. A lot of people were terrified. Accountants in particular were terrified. I have never seen accountants be more strict and concerned about their futures than in the period 2003 to 2007. I don't want to say that they've stopped being concerned, but they were really terrified that they were going to be next. So there is little question in my mind that individual prosecutions and the threat of their company being taken down out of business had a serious impact. Whether it's affected corporate behavior, Felix, I think less so, because there are always going to be venal people who will calculate their odds and try to get around this. And I think it's as much a matter of integrity as it is about
and,
the corporate
And do
law.
You think those venal people, to Jesse's thesis, is those venal people, if they're atop big enough companies and have enough money and enough lawyers, essentially have impunity these days?
I think it's gotten close. I mean, the Supreme Court has changed some of the standards by which you can prosecute people, and they've made that far, far more difficult. I don't want to prejudge our discussion of Hobby Lobby, but it's an example. If you have enough defenses and set your defenses up correctly, the road to prosecution today is extraordinarily difficult. So unless it's something particularly blatant that you've done, like actually take money and put it into your own bank account, I think it has gotten more difficult to prosecute these folks.
And I really do think this is very important, because I know another thing that you point out is this idea that the Obama administration is really focused on changing essentially corporate culture, this kind of more idea of like, we want to change systemically to prevent this from happening in the future. But again, if you give impunity to the people at the top, you can't possibly change the culture.
Exactly. I think this has been the great failing of the Obama administration, where they had a very technocratic response to this and a kind of systemic response. The notion that you would reform the banking system by passing Dodd-Frank, which is sort of infernally technocratic, and not couple it with, and then these enforcement, where you have settlements and maybe a monitor to come in and sort of look at the corporate behavior instead of prosecuting individuals. And what my argument is, if you decouple these, or if you neglect the investigations and prosecutions and public airing of the bad behavior, you undermine the legitimacy of your efforts. So I think these things need to be coupled. The Obama administration, the technocratic sort of democratic, the Democrats' kind of default is to look at these problems systemically. The old-fashioned Republican idea was weed out the bad apples, which was insufficient, but better than what the Republicans now do, which is hands off the crime.
More bad apples.
And more, yeah, let's bring the bad apples in and no systemic reform.
And let's elect one president of the United States.
Yeah, exactly. absolutely. So we have a deeply broken system full of injustice that has undermined the credibility of obviously Donald Trump and Jeff Sessions, but also the Obama administration, undermined Hillary, and I think led to Trump, has eroded belief. I think it's deeply contributed to this notion that we have an inequitable society.
Do you think this is driven in part by the fact that so many of these people now make up the donor class for pretty much all politicians, so that you don't want to be the person who takes on Wall Street as Elliot Spitzer did, or takes on all these corporations because the donors won't show up?
Yes, absolutely. So one of the big problems, I think, is that the Obama administration and the Democrats draw from the same well for their prosecutors that the Republicans do. It's just slightly different firms or slightly different people, but it's the same law firms and the same culture of Washington criminal defense lawyers that the Republicans do. So the Democrats might go to Wilmer Hale, the Republicans go to Jones Day, but all those people are on the same cocktail circuit. They've gone to the same schools. They send their children to the same elite private schools. And if you are attempting as a prosecutor to prosecute these people, there is an enormous amount of sort of class affinity that you have to overcome. And you just don't see a very well-educated Goldman Sachs banker who is articulate, who might have a degree in, say, antiquities or something like that, as a criminal. They just don't see him as a criminal. So they have to overcome an enormous amount of – so it is what you said earlier, Larry, about the courts making this more difficult, but it also is a cultural and incentive issue.
Yeah, I'm thinking back to, you know, when – we prosecuted Martha Stewart and she went to jail. And I'm trying to think how, like, that would be more or less unthinkable today. It wasn't that long ago.
Well, I don't entirely agree with that, because I think that what they point to are these sort of piecemeal, discrete issues of kind of technicalities and minor things that, so Martha Stewart, they prosecute, and we'll get to this in a second, people like Kelly or Martha Stewart or Raj Rajaratnam, these discrete crimes from people who have high profiles. What they can't do is systemically look at crimes at Walmart or a Google or an Apple or a GM or any of the big banks and work their way up through the ranks to get to the highest level corporate executive that they can. Right. That poses too difficult
and so
problem
that,
for them.
So let's quickly wrap this up with a short little tale of Jordan Weissman's favorite high school buddy, Martin Shkreli. Martin Shkreli, you know, is the most hated man in America for doing unspeakable things to drug prices. And he was the CEO of a couple of different drug companies and everyone hated them and they were kind of skeevy in many different ways. And he is now being criminally prosecuted. And the irony is that the criminal prosecution has nothing to do with him being the CEO of these drug companies.
Although you maybe could argue, would this case have come to trial if he wasn't the most hated person in the world? I mean, what he did was pretty blatant. He essentially was using this company as a piggy bank to pay investors in these hedge funds that went belly up. But I do wonder if he wasn't Martin Shkreli, if this would have been prosecuted in the way it is. I mean, I'm glad it is, but.
And my answer is he wouldn't. And not only that, but you have got another example of a company that is experiencing impunity, it seems, it's a little too early to say, while Shkreli is being on trial, which is Valiant. Valiant was a company that appears to have engaged in an enormous amount of deception, gouging people on prices, not revealing its true financials to investors. And that investigation, if it is going on, it's been reported that it's going on, is making no progress. Whether they'll bring charges eventually, we don't know. But you couple that, that is a big company that was $40 billion market cap, maybe more, $80 billion market cap at one point, a darling of Wall Street. If they went after those companies, you would restore some credibility. But instead, they're going after little
more. They're hard cases, but they don't have easy smoking guns or
absolutely
hated. I mean, Martha Stewart was easy. She got a phone call. Yeah,
but Tyco was hard. You know,
Tyco was hard.
So and Enron was hard.
Enron
so
was
we
very hard.
We think of Enron a little bit. We think of it as an obvious fraud on reflection. But in fact, if you look at the cases against Lay and Skilling, there was no direct evidence against them. What they had to do was they didn't put stupid shit in email, which is the way they rely on making cases now. And instead, what they had to do is the old-fashioned way, treat it like a criminal organization, a mob organization, and roll up the capos to get to the roll up the soldiers to get to the capos to get to the capo di tutti capi. And I think my argument is today's Justice Department could not prosecute Lay and Skilling successfully.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
So let's move on, Jesse, to the place where there's most sort of anger right now, which is the West Coast, which is Silicon Valley. And, you know, we never stop talking about
a lot of anger to go around, but okay, I'll spread some around.
The New York Times has been out in front on reporting about like the endemic nature of sexual harassment among venture capitalists. We recently had a bunch of resignations of people like Justin Kohlbeck and Dave McClure, who are venture capitalists. Half of the Uber senior, if not all of the Uber senior management, seems to have like left or been fired. There's constant rumblings about, I mean, not even rumblings, but there's quite vocal talk from virtually every woman in Silicon Valley about how horrible the atmosphere is there. And the culture of impunity has certainly existed until now. It might slowly be fraying around the edges. But again, like the absolute worst thing that ever seems to happen to anyone is they get fired, right? Again, this is not something where we're going to see criminal prosecutions of what seem to be, on a relatively frequent level, criminal acts.
Well, that seems like a harder question. I mean, to some extent, there has been, I mean, it's significant accountability that Travis Kalanick gets ousted from his company, that all these guys are resigning from venture capital firms. You know, whether sexual harassment, which this there are multiple examples of appalling behavior, turns into criminal behavior, that's a very difficult line, and I'm not sure that terrible and inappropriate emails hitting on women will cross the line to criminal acts that are imprisoning. I think that the one important aspect here is cultural opprobrium. And we rewarded a lot of bankers after the financial crisis by putting Chuck Prince on a panel at Aspen Ideas as if he was an intellectual. To the extent that the culture changes in Silicon Valley, that's an important check on corporate entitlement.
I'll be interested to see how many of these people resurface in other firms or in advisory consulting positions very quickly, because I think that will really speak to cultural change.
Right, because McClure, in theory, stepped down, but he still seems to be very much involved. I am very suspicious that there's any change here whatsoever, and I just find it infuriating, the like emails and the blog posts that come out from these guys where they're just like, oh, you know, I messed up. I was a creep. I just made a mistake. And I'm just like, it's not a mistake. Like this, and even though it's like, oh, they're taking, you know, responsibility, they're not taking responsibility. It's just another way of them trying to make themselves be like, I get it. I'm one of the good guys. I'll reform. And it's like, no, this is a larger problem than sexual harassment. Like that is one part that kind of everybody talks about, but we then aren't dealing with why is sexual harassment allowed? Well, part of the reason it's allowed is because this is an all-male environment. Why is it an all-male environment? Because of so many systemic issues down the line, so many instances of kind of sexual discrimination, gender discrimination that leads to this, to an environment where this kind of thing can flower.
And it's not just Silicon Valley. I mean, it's also Fox News. But there are cultures where this kind of behavior is rampant and universal and generally accepted, and Silicon Valley is definitely one of those cultures. And Larry is absolutely right that, I mean, historically, this would happen quite a lot, that, you know, you would get allegations against some individual. He would quietly leave some firm because, you know, they had a difference in investment strategies or some, like, you know, euphemism like that. And then he would pop up somewhere else and no one would know the true story. So it's very important for sunshine to be shone on these things. But anyone who ever attempted to do that in the past would get incredibly angry threats of litigation and this kind of thing and would get cut out of deal flow. And I am equally suspicious that that's really going to change. The people in Silicon Valley still tend to retaliate against the people who attack their friends.
Yes, in every industry. And again, like, when you are a woman in almost any industry, you usually deal with some form of sexual harassment. It just, almost every woman I know. And almost no one will ever do anything, because if you weigh the cost and benefits, you're like, why would I? Like, it has to raise to such a high level. And you also would almost always have to see other people bringing cases against this person before you'll do anything. And that is simply just almost in every industry.
I think Silicon Valley is particularly interesting, though, because the whole culture there is predicated on breaking rules and creating new paradigms.
Exactly.
And so, you know, when Uber would go into a town, they didn't care that their service was legal or not. They were going to run it until somebody actually forced them to stop. So if rules don't matter to you in your culture, and they rewarded people to be rule breakers, I think it was one of the things on Travis's manifesto. Well, if you tell people to be rule breakers, how can you go, let's break every rule except this one? That's not a corporate culture that has any ability to, you know, remain working.
And it's not only that, but they're so invested in their righteousness that they envelop all of their branding and all of their self-image in this notion that whatever they're doing brings wonderful things to the world, that they're not evil, that they're in fact bestowing their genius and generosity upon the masses. And so, you know, and everything is line caught and free range and ethically sourced. And so they have this sense that they do no wrong. And that in anything that they, any action that they take is justified because of the ends. It's a pretty appalling culture, and I'm glad that it's being, I'm surprised that you're so skeptical, because I am, just from this coast, flabbergasted at the number of people who are going on the record and the amount of the women, the courage of all these women standing up strikes me as a really telling moment. And of course, it did start with an extraordinary act of one non-journalist posting a blog item on her own personal blog. So it's not a piece of journalism that really broke this. But then the Information had stories, the New York Times had stories, and so it's building and building. I'm astonished at how much momentum it has gotten in the last few weeks.
Yeah, and we'll see where it actually goes. I don't know. I'm just a little dubious.
And do you think that, okay, here's the question. How will we know whether anything real has actually changed? And how long will it take for us to know that?
I mean, I think part of it will be as Silicon Valley matures. I guess that's more of my hope.
Is it not 50 years old? I mean,
like, no, but I mean, if you're talking, because I do think that if you're, my assumption would be that a lot of this stuff comes out of kind of VC culture and a lot of smaller startups that don't have human resources departments, that don't have adults in charge. And as that starts to come into play, and as, again, if there are actually significant consequences, maybe at some point, and when you start to get more women at different levels, then you'll start to see some changes. Because I will say, kind of going on the other side, I do think there have been significant changes in banking and finance and related to this.
It was starting from such a low bar that in the 90s, they were having strippers on the trading floor. So, you know.
Right. But I also say, like, you know, I've worked in all male teams where it was fine. And this is another reason why I really do push back when people say, like, oh, it's just because, you know, when you have a group of all guys, you know, they just behave like this because that's, and I'm like, no, that's actually not true, because I've worked with all men where they don't behave like that.
Exactly. And that was, you know, when
hashtag
when
not all men.
When Donald Trump, you know, when that tape came out about his pussy grabbing comments and people started talking about locker room talk, I'm like, I have been in locker rooms. I have never heard anyone talk like that in locker rooms. It's not like there's a cultural thing there, yeah, beyond just like a group of guys thing.
Right. And again, I think this is, it's larger than just sexual harassment. And I think it's, again, it's part of so many barriers to getting women into higher echelons of power. And once that starts to happen, I think hopefully then some things will change.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Larry Coben, I want to give you the floor, and because all we have been trying to do desperately is not talk about Hobby Lobby. Now we can talk about Hobby Lobby in this completely bonkers case. Where to start? The whole idea of trade in antiquities and antiquities being things which are bought and sold. Tell us like what that is.
That trade in antiquities is as old as the antiquities themselves. People have always wanted to collect objects of great beauty, objects of historical significance, and own them. The issue is, when and how should you be able to do that? And what's happened normally is that people go and they steal these things, or they take them out of the ground, digging up archaeological sites, destroying our history, destroying our past, and then sell them through illicit markets. So there isn't.
And if there was no market, if there was no demand for these objects, that act of destruction would probably not happen.
Felix, absolutely correct. As you know, I run a foundation predicated on exactly that principle. So I'm a huge believer in this is a demand-driven phenomenon. I mean, people wouldn't refine and sell cocaine if nobody wanted to actually use cocaine. So antiquities are like, I guess maybe cocaine for classicists.
and the classicist in question here is a guy called Stephen Green.
I would call him a biblical archaeologist collector, biblical archaeology collector.
And he's trying to put together a museum of biblical artifacts.
Yes. I mean, the origins of American and European archaeology or modern actually begins with trying to prove the Bible true. If you look at why the UPenn Museum or the Met Museum are founded.
Isn't it?
They're
I'm
groups.
Confused. What? The Bible isn't true? The scales are falling from my eyes.
You know, I can't say yes and I can't say no. There's somebody greater power, I think, that can make that decision. But that's the origins of archaeology. And so people would go off to Mesopotamia, to Ur and Nineveh, try to find all of these places that are mentioned in the Bible, try to find mentions of the rulers, and then go, well, you see, it says that so-and-so did this on the cuneiform. Therefore, everything he did in the Bible must be true. Or Abraham was born in Ur. We found Ur. Therefore, everything that Abraham is mentioned in the Bible is. So this is the origin, Felix, of archaeology, in fact.
Wow. And so when the Green family, who own Hobby Lobby and are multi-billionaires, and are also devout Christians, decide to build a museum of biblical artifacts, they're basically continuing a tradition which goes back centuries.
They are continuing a tradition that goes back centuries, but they're not. It's different from biblical archaeology, as I described, which was scientific excavations, objects recorded, information and context known. The big problem is they have 40,000 objects. No one has any idea where these objects come from. They think they're from Iraq, but they don't know if they're from Ur, from Nineveh, what site they're from, how old they are, you know, what they were found in relation to, which building they were found in. So all of the information that those artifacts, which could tell us so much about ancient people, is now completely lost. And so it's not the same. The tradition was, let's actually study this. Let's not collect it and forget about the knowledge that's incorporated within them.
So, okay. So let's now talk about this case.
Sure.
No, I mean, this is completely bizarre to me, but the defendant in the case is actually like 450 cuneiform tablets.
I love civil forfeiture case names.
And in fact, if you actually read the decision, it's not against Hobby Lobby. It's against the people that sold Hobby Lobby the objects, because the objects were confiscated before they got to Hobby Lobby.
Well, Hobby Lobby settles.
Hobby Lobby settles, but Hobby Lobby basically settles for forfeiting money that came as a result of something happening with those objects, and we don't know what. I don't know if they sold them to somebody or something transpired. They settle for a pittance.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you want to talk about a slap on the wrist? That's maybe a slap on the pinky.
Yeah. Well, I want to get to that in a second, but you've.
So Hobby Lobby then takes the case. There's no, you know, you come back to the point we were discussing before. What kind of a deterrent is this? You forfeit the objects that you had to have known were not legally acquired.
Because it's actually basically impossible to acquire that number of objects with those objects all having proper provenance and everyone knowing where they come from.
Well, there's that, number one. Number two, if you know what you're buying, I'm not sure why you label everything, you know, tile, floor tiles.
Right. So this is the point that I wanted to bring up, which is it's inexplicable to me that this is not a criminal case because you have clear evidence of intent. And as that's the thing that's most difficult in these difficult criminal cases in corporations, is that you have to get into the heads of these corporate executives, and you can use evidence. And what evidence they have here is, one, they were warned. There was an attorney at the company that said, guys, be careful here. This is breaking the rules. And then two, they conceal their activities.
And they're like, why are the payment to seven different personal bank accounts in six different countries? And you're like, how is this not just, you obviously knew what you were doing.
It is a case, and I don't understand why, and there should be some public accounting for this, why this is not a criminal action brought by the federal government.
Oh, and beyond that, why are they settling with Hobby Lobby, which is a faceless corporation, you know, based in Delaware or wherever it is, when Hobby Lobby was clearly just being used as like a useful corporate front by the Green family, who are individuals?
I don't know why. I mean, I don't know why the Museum of the Bible, where all of these objects were supposed to end up, doesn't seem to be a part of this case. They don't seem to want to go to anyone individually. I presume that some clever lawyers prepared a whole lot of interesting internal paperwork that hopefully we'll get to see at some point, that put up defenses. And, you know, as the same way that the Godfather wrote, always do everything through his consigliere, I have no doubt that the same thing transpired here, and that there are layers and cutouts that will make it more difficult to get top person.
Do you think the Department of Justice tried to go after the Museum of the Bible and the Green family?
I don't. I think there's not enough caring or interest in the department to take on antiquities-related cases. I mean, the Department of Justice in 2004 prosecuted a journalist named Joseph Broud, who brought three or four, I can't remember exactly, tablets back through customs and didn't declare them. But that was an easy case. He came with them. It was clearly illegal. He lied to customs that he had them, and he was an individual person who didn't have, you know, it was a slam dunk case for them. So I think, if it's not a slam dunk, they don't want to do it. They're only interested in stopping these things when they think it might be funding ISIS or somebody like that.
Okay, so let's ask you about that, because, I mean, there have been a bunch of reports in this Hobby Lobby case that the money that they were spending on these antiquities may in large part have gone to ISIS. Is that true?
Probably not, because the case predates ISIS, but it certainly worked to create a market which ISIS is exploiting. These particular objects were seized in 2011, which really predates the rise of ISIS.
It's taken 6 years for them to just come up with a slap on the wrist.
It's absurd. I mean, the moment they seized those objects, everybody who knows anything about this field knew that they were not legal objects. Patty Gerstenblith, who runs the Cultural Law Center at DePaul University, said she met with them and, quote, read them the Riot Act, describing what you could and could not import. Essentially, if you import antiquities from Iraq, 99.99% of the time, that's not they're not going to be legal objects, so you probably shouldn't do it.
I will just say my favorite part, though, about this entire case is that part of the reason we're not prosecuting the Greens is again, they're saying that there's some separation between themselves and their corporation. I would just like to go back to the Supreme Court case in which the entire reason that the company has essentially a kind of freedom of religion right is because it's a closely held family corporation that is connected to the religious beliefs of the individuals who own it. So that's my favorite contradiction about this.
And so, Larry, what do you think in an ideal world would happen to the Museum of the Bible and anyone else who aspires to bringing antiquities together in museums? Do antiquities just basically not belong in museums?
No, I think contextualized antiquities belong in museums. They're wonderful. I mean, many museums, their objects were properly excavated and recorded. I think it's great that people get to see them. It creates an excitement about the past. It lets us know our potential as human beings, both good and bad. Archaeology, I think, is incredibly important. But simply effectively stealing objects out of the ground and destroying archaeological sites to get them, I would love to see those folks go to jail. I don't know that we're ever going to commit the amount of resources. If we're not going to commit them to these giant financial frauds we were talking about before, these smaller antiquities cases, they're not. I mean, that's why we also have to work on, you know, the source countries and making it uneconomic for people to, you know, take these things out of the ground by instead creating economic development programs that utilize these objects and utilize these sites within their countries, like we do in the Sustainable Preservation Initiative, to make that happen.
Okay, so plug for your organization.
I thought I just did one. No, I mean, what we
it's called SPI. It's
called the Sustainable Preservation Initiative.
And you're mostly active in Peru and around there?
Peru, Guatemala, and Jordan right now, and expanding to three more countries this year, so stay tuned.
And your project is to basically monetize antiquities while they're still in the ground.
It's essentially, yes, to monetize these sites and make them sustainable economic assets for their communities rather than one-time destroyed ones where the benefits end up working for some middleman or some collector.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
It's time for a numbers round. Anna.
So my number is 6. And that is the number of tax rates in the goods and services tax that was just instituted in India. So,
wow.
Yes. So this is legitimately like a huge deal.
This is a sales tax?
It's essentially like a VAT, but it's huge. I mean, in theory, it's replacing this mishmash of just like countless local taxes that has made it essentially impossible to move goods back and forth between different states in India. So ultimately, this is, in theory, huge in terms of really making India a single market. However, there have been so many, it's really been rushed. There's a lot of politics involved in how things are getting classified, which rate they're getting put under. So it's not, by
so
no
it,
means
it's
what it should be.
Depending on what kind of a good you are. If you're an orange, it's one kind of thing.
Literally,
if you're a
yes.
book, it's another kind of
yeah,
thing.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's still far more complicated than it should be, but it's actually a really big deal.
My number is one of my favorite little statistical things, that when prices go down, prices go up. This is the Manhattan real estate market. And we just had the second quarter numbers come in for the Manhattan real estate, and they all went up. The median Manhattan apartment is $1.2 million. Now, the average Manhattan apartment is $2.2 million. The average condo is $3.1 million. And the average new condo is $4.7 million. These numbers are all not only enormous, but they're all rising as well. And the reason why they're all rising...
You are a property owner in Manhattan, Louis. There should be full disclosure here, yeah, for this advertisement.
The reason why they're all rising is, you're going to love this one, because at the top end of the market, those new condos, which average $4.7 million, those prices have been coming down. They're down about 10%. And because they're down about 10% at the very, very high end of the market, you know, they're sort of $20, $30, $40 million apartments, a lot more of them are selling. They finally reduced the prices to the point at which people were willing to buy them. And now you just have a whole bunch of these, you know, $20 and $30 million deals, and those are bringing all of the averages up. So if the prices come down, the prices go up. It's amazing.
It's good for that gated community
and, on 57th Street.
The entire island.
Jesse.
My number is 0.29. You guys may think I have a fixed idea here, but so there's a federal judge in West Virginia who put a little Excel spreadsheet in an opinion excoriating U.S. attorneys for doing too many plea bargains and never bringing people to trial, which of course infects not only the kind of problems in the criminal justice system for street criminals, but also this fear of trials infects why we don't bring top corporate executives to trial and then try to put them in prison. 0.29 is the average in 2016 of the criminal trials handled by each federal prosecutor in the country, and that compares to 8 in 1973. They used to do many, many more trials. Trials are a public airing of
evidence. So wait, we have on average, each prosecutor takes 0.29 cases to trial each year.
Yes, fewer, one every 3 years, roughly. So this lack of trial experience erodes justice, one, because trials are public airing of evidence and the public gets to see it, but also it erodes their skill set.
Larry, give us a number.
My number, Felix, is 5,500. 5,500 is the number of objects that were seized in the Hobby Lobby case.
Whoa.
And 5,500 years ago is about what the time when we found the first cuneiforms in Sumeria.
Well, I mean,
so I think 5,500
years
going
ago
on there.
Was when we were
this
creating.
This was a Dan Brown novel. Exactly. Like, yeah.
So
first
5500, if you can figure out that, you probably can find the Ark and all kinds of other things too.
So 5,500 is like the number of years ago that we were creating these tablets.
That's really the oldest cuneiform tablets that have been found to date.
And according to Hobby Lobby, isn't that when the world was also started?
It was just before that.
Okay, well, I think that's it for this week. Thank you for listening to Slate Money. And if you like this, you should also check out the other Slate podcast called Working, which is hosted by Jacob Brogan. This season, they're talking to various people who work in Detroit. They've talked to a hair care entrepreneur, an urban farmer, and a battery technician at a big car firm. Our email address, as ever, is slatemoney@slate.com. Thanks to Dan Schrader for producing this week. Thanks to Anna Szymanski for coming on, but mostly, many, many thanks to Larry Coben and Jesse Eisinger for coming on and telling us all about white-collar crime. We will talk to you next week on Slate Money.